Hello, everyone, and welcome to Recovery Chronicles. My name is Tom Regan. I am a licensed addiction counselor and a certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck, North Dakota. And this radio program, Recovery Chronicles, is a celebration of recovery. We interview every week people who are in long-term recovery. And our guest today is Brandon Bagenstos. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, you did.
Brandon Bagenstos. And he's one of those fortunate persons in long-term recovery. We've known each other for a while. For one thing, we participate in a group together called Runners Against Destructive Decisions, and I'll let you talk about that. But welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I feel blessed to be here. So
Yeah. Thanks for coming. Where did you grow up? Tell us a little bit about your background and your family.
I'm 33 years old. I grew up in Bismarck, North Dakota here, Bismarck native. I grew up. I got a mother and father, and I got an older brother. He's 4 years older than me and lives out in Minneapolis, and he's married and has one kid. And I grew up here going to local school and I played sports. I played hockey and I played soccer and continued with sports until almost through high school. So just right before high school is when the sports kind of stopped. So
any college?
Yes, I did. Yep. I graduated from high school, from Bismarck High School in 2004. And then I started school a year and a half later. And then I graduated from Bismarck State College in 2008. So,
okay. You said you had one brother, an older brother. Anybody else in the family?
No. Okay. Just my older brother, and that's it. Just me and him. So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. And as I said, Brandon is a person in long-term recovery. And so when and how were you first introduced to drugs?
Oh, gosh.
And what was your drug of choice?
I guess it was more in yours, actually. But I guess it didn't really matter. But when I was growing up, I did start off with alcohol, you know, and I started drinking a little bit here and there. And it started off in elementary school. I'd say maybe fourth or fifth grade, I took my first sip. It continued and progressed from there. And then a little bit of marijuana. And then over the years, it just continued to move to one drug to another, you know. And I guess my drug of choice was methamphetamine and alcohol. So,
Methamphetamine can be extremely powerful. I mean, and quite easy to become addicted to. How did it hit you? How did it first affect you?
Oh man, well, it was right after I got out of college. It's pretty fresh in my memory because I remember when things just spiraled downhill. They did before, but it went real quick using that substance. But I remember specifically I just had graduated college and I was a little bit stressed, a little bit unsure of where I was going next, you know, with my future and stuff. And you know, the alcohol and the drugs just continued to get a little more worse and a little more worse. And I remember I used methamphetamine for the first night, and I remember it gave me the energy that I was so craving. It gave me the alertness. It gave me things. It made me forget about a lot of the past and a lot of traumatic stuff that happened to me in the past. I tend to just forget about that and drown it out. And so I found something that I liked, and it did for me what I thought was going to be, you know, some benefits for me, but it ended up, you know, taking my life downhill. So
yeah. How did you take it? How did you take the meth or use it?
I would smoke it. Mm-hmm. I would snort it. I would eat it. I have never been an IV user, so I never did it that way or nothing. But it didn't matter which way I did it. It still affected my body and it still affected my health. And I actually did. I don't know if it's a direct cause of my methamphetamine use, but I did have to have a major nose surgery. I had to have a deviated septum surgery during when I was heavily using methamphetamine. And that was a pretty tough surgery to have to go through.
Yeah. Did your habit get expensive?
Yes, it did. It really did. I was working off and on, and you know, I had money for it, but it got expensive. It really, really did. So, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
When did your drug use, whatever the drug might be, when did it start to cause problems, either, you know, relationship problems or school problems or job problems?
I would say, you know, after college and when I first started using meth, and I remember it led into a couple arrests, being arrested for possession of meth. And then at this point in time, my job was aware of my drug use, and, you know, they would not want me back for a season, and then I would clean up, and then they would want me back the next year until I would use again, and then they wouldn't want me back. It continued mm-hmm. to get worse and worse and worse. The more I used, the more the consequences were, whether it would be, you know, consequences at home with my family, consequences with friends and relationships, you know, the job and stuff like that. Everything was uncontrollable. It was unmanageable.
Yeah.
in all aspects.
Yeah. How did it make you feel physically? I mean, for example, not while you were high, I mean, but the letdown afterwards, and being strung out, as they say.
Oh man, well, being strung out was a very, it was an experience I've never experienced before. You know, the not sleeping for 2 or 3 days, and then coming off of the drug, I would sleep for constantly 2 or 3 or 4 days at a time. Mm. And, you know, while under the influence of the drug, I would not eat. So then, you know, my body, you know, I would lose weight, and I think I was maybe down to about maybe 160 pounds. And that's really low for me. But it was bad. And then I couldn't sleep, and nightmares and stuff like that. The paranoia, psychosis that I was dealing with too. I mean, that was,
yeah. What was that like? I don't think people who don't use understand that sometimes. What kind of paranoia and psychosis did you have? What were you afraid of or imagining or?
Oh, I was afraid of the individuals that I dealt with in the past. Whether there could have been repercussions of me kind of just stepping away from these people, and trying to, you know, better myself and distance myself from toxic people like that, drug users. Other than that, it was law enforcement too. You know, I try to remind myself every day that it wasn't the cops that were trying to make my life miserable. It was because I was doing things that, you know, it brought attention to them, you know, and I'm blessed that everything I got arrested for, you know, it was for a reason. I wasn't doing good out there in the community, you know, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
So when you were arrested, were you generally pulled over or arrested for other things?
Yeah. I mean, I've been pulled over many, many times, and the arrests that started with methamphetamine offenses, I was driving and I got pulled over for, I'm not even sure what it was for. It was for, my car was being described in something in a crime, and they pulled me over, and they ended up, you know, I was under the influence, you know, so they knew something was up. So then they ended up searching my car and charging me. So
yeah. Yeah. Ever do any jail time?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I've done numerous days, you know, weekends. They used to call me a weekender because, you know, I'd go in and see the judge and they would say, you know, serve 2 or 3 weekends at a time. I think the most I ever did was 10 days, 10 yeah. days in Burley County Jail. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you must have reached a point, somewhere along the line where you said enough is enough. I have to change. And so when did that happen and how did that take place?
Well, it's a beautiful thing to have to, you know, I know people who have been in jail and got down on their knees and said, this is enough. They were at their lowest point. And I was at my lowest point when I was in that cell with that big heavy door closing, you know, behind me. But my lowest point was not being in jail. It wasn't in a psychiatric unit. It was actually just in my room at home. And I was on my knees and I was sick and tired of living the way I was living. I was sick and tired of making these promises to my higher power, telling him, you know, I'm done. I don't want to keep on doing this. And then 3 or 4 days or a week later or 2 weeks or whatever, I would continue to go back and do the same thing. And at my age now, I came to realize that if this continued on, I was going to end up in prison for the rest of my life, or I was going to end up taking my own life. Yeah. And I didn't want to do that. I got a lot of dreams that I want to fulfill, and I got a lot of life to live. So,
yeah. So, how did you enter recovery with a capital R? Did you start going to community support meetings, or what happened there? Or did you go to treatment?
Okay. I did go to treatment at West Central, and I went there and I did the outpatient program. I think this was back in 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. And, I did very well, which I see a pattern. I do really, really well. But the problem is that I struggled before with maintaining that stuff. And so I did aftercare, and I ended up relapsing, and I was first introduced to the community programs that they got, the support rooms that they have. Mm-hmm. And I actually was told by my probation officer that I should try one.
Yeah.
And so I did, and I went, and I've been going back ever since.
Yeah.
And so it's been 8 years mm-hmm. since I've been going back.
Wonderful. Yeah. So, you know, you've learned a lot being in recovery, you know, for 8 years, even though there's been some slips or some relapsing, et cetera. So, what do you think has been, or let's talk about maybe three things that are the most important aspects or elements of your recovery?
Number one, I would say my relationship with God.
Yes.
That's the first and foremost relationship that I try to strengthen and that I try to grow in each and every day.
The spirituality.
The spirituality is a beautiful thing, and it's personal to me because, you know, there's things that I struggle with that not everybody else struggles with. And I feel like the biggest battle that I face every day is the battle against myself, the battle against my own mind. Because the enemy of the devil is always trying to tempt me, you know, and I always just remember to myself that my God is bigger than any enemy out there, you know, and number two, I would have to say my family, family that I have has been supporting me.
When you say family, mom, dad, brother, et cetera.
My mother, my father, and my brother. Yep. Yes. Yep.
Nice.
They support me 100%. They always have, and I believe that they always will. I feel like their prayers kind of got me into this point when I'm here talking to you, you know, celebrating recovery, as you said at the beginning. I am celebrating recovery today, and it's a blessing. So, mm-hmm. And then I would say number three would be meditation.
Mm-hmm. Prayer and meditation, or
prayer
meditation
and meditation
specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Prayer, you hit it right on the dot, yeah. Tom. I wake up every morning and I don't have to get on my knees and pray. I have to connect with him. I have to let him know what I'm looking for throughout the day, how I can better serve other people and not be so selfish, you know, and stuck in myself. And then the meditation is just quieting my mind and mm-hmm. letting all the voices just drowned out and just remember who has the best care for me, and that's God. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I have come to know you as a spiritual person.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
You know, I often catch you reading an inspirational book, or, you know, or reading a book about spirituality, yep. or maybe a book of meditations, yep. or something like that. Of course, I get to see you at RAD, you know, Runners Against Destructive Decisions. Let's talk about RAD a little bit. When did you hear about RAD, and why did you join up?
You know, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago I was first told about RAD from a friend of mine. who used to see me at my lowest points, and she had told me about runners against destructive decisions. Mm-hmm. And I gave it a try a couple times, but I never stuck with it. And I didn't feel anything when I was going because I wasn't in the right state of mind to actually want to be there. So I guess last year I started communicating and building relationships with these people who are in this RAD program, and that program has helped me out so much. It's given me dreams that, you know, it's given me goals to reach. I'm currently going to start training for a 10K this summer. I'm going to do the Run for Change.
It's basically a running group, walking group, exercise group.
We could take anybody who wants to come and join us. You know, you can walk, you can run, you can lift weights. And, you know, I think it's the fellowship that's the biggest part of it. And I think it's all of us kind of getting together as one and just wanting to exercise and, you know, try to just... you know, feed our body with exercise and stuff like that. It's a healthy way, you know, to release some of the stuff that we're dealing with.
Sure. You know, and it's, it was started by Judge David Reich in Bismarck, and it's, the target audience, you might say, is people in recovery, but it's really also for people who want to support, people in recovery. You know, for example, Judge Reich himself and our Bismarck police chief is coming to. Yep. And if you want more information, there is a Facebook page, and probably I think there's a website also. But we meet and it's RADD, Runners Against Destructive Disease. They sponsor the annual Santa Claus. Run, by the way, every December as well. But I should remind people we're talking to Brandon Bagenstos, and he's a person in long term recovery. He's from the Bismarck Mandan area, and so what do you say, Brandon, to people listening right now, listening to our radio program, listening to you talk about recovery, and you know, and maybe they're. They're a mom and dad, and their son or daughter is in trouble with drugs, or maybe it's someone listening right now. They know they're in trouble. They know they have to change, or they'll be dead, mm-hmm. as you said. Yep. What do we say to them right now? What to do?
You know, there's. You know, it's different for everybody, Tom. Mm-hmm. I know that once a person reaches that point and he's off that falling off point, that breaking off point, a person first just needs to get a clear mind. You know, get the drugs and alcohol out of his system. You know, so he can think clearly. That's what I had to do.
Mm-hmm. Some people need treatment to do that. They may need what we call residential treatment. To do that, where they stay at the recovery center night and day, so that they can be monitored and taken away from that drug and those cravings and urges in that environment.
Yes, that's a good point. You know, never overlook the possibility and the thought that there are facilities and programs out there that a person can go to. You know, if a person mm-hmm. is just really wanting to stop and needs to be kind of taken out of that environment, taken out of their home or whatever, wherever is going on and stuff like that, in a treatment facility is a great starter for people. I know for me, I had to kind of be taken away from the environment that I was in, the temptations and
the people
as well. Yes,
they always say people, places, and things.
Yeah, people, places, and things. You know, you can't change those things. You know, and as long as that you give in to temptation, you know, nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
You know, so inpatient, outpatient, you know, is a beautiful thing. It actually gives a person direction. You know, on how to start, how to build that foundation, and go from there.
Discover those tools, learn those tools.
Absolutely.
How did you, one of the downfalls is often, for example, when someone relapses, when a patient relapses, we might often ask them, how did it happen? And why? And they say, well, I was with somebody that had it. Yeah. I mean, it was there. So that's, and you hear that, I hate to say it, but that's usually why it happens. I mean, and how did you, when you were trying to stay straight and you were, you know, with somebody who had it, or somebody would call you and say, hey, Brendan, I've got something that you ought to, that you're going to be interested in. How did you avoid that scenario, that temptation?
Oh man, that's, you know, that's all too familiar with me, Tom. Yeah. You know, I got a good saying that I kind of live by. It's not what happened to me, it's what happened for me. In a sense that me personally, for my recovery, I had to fall a couple times. I'm lucky that I didn't lose my life over those slips that I had. It's not something that I wanted, but it's something that happened, and I can't have a lot of shame and guilt about that. I just had to learn, pick myself back off the ground, stand tall, and keep moving forward, and just keep trying my best. For what happened for me was, I was at work, and sobriety was going really, really well, and recovery and whatnot. Somebody had some stuff, and I guess for me, when it gets brought up and I see it day and day and day after day after day, and then somebody asks me, do you want something, time and time and time again, eventually I'm going to give in. If I'm not strong in my recovery, eventually I'll give in.
And that's why I really like the saying, when you hang around the barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. There's so much truth in that.
There is so much truth to that, too. I remember early on in sobriety, I would... you know, I was part of a pool league, and so I would go to the bar and kind of shoot pool. And also I have an extended family member who actively still uses, and I pray for him each and every day. But I would go over there just to stop in and say hi, you know, and see how he's doing, just to make sure he's alive, you know. And there was one time where I was celebrating my 1 year of sobriety, and I went over to you know, check on my family member to see if he was okay, see if he was well, see if he needed any food or anything else like that. And they pulled out drugs in front of me, and it was a shock. And ever since then, I asked myself, you know, you can't be in those dangerous situations. You can't allow yourself to go do that. You got to distance yourself. You got to do you, Brandon, you know. Those are dangerous places to be. You know, like you said, people, places, and things, you got to change those things. Otherwise, you're not going to change.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. We as addiction counselors often have to say, you've got to change your life from top to bottom. It's a totally different lifestyle.
That is so true.
And a lot of people, they don't want to hear that, you know, because I know, speaking for myself, when I first recovered many years ago, and alcohol and cannabis were my drugs of choice, I was so depressed about it. I thought, well, how am I ever going to have fun again? I'm going to be just bored all the time if I can't go out and, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And have a good time. But of course, now I can say, in all honesty, my life has never been better. So let's talk about your life as it stands today. I mean, I know you as a person with gratitude and, as a spiritual person, a thankful person, a person who helps others. So,
yeah, I try my best each and every day to just try to be obedient to God, meaning that, you know, there's certain things that God requires from me, you know, and that's to show love and respect to other people. I love praying for other people, and I ask other people to pray for me as well. You know, and when I'm struggling, I ask, can you say a prayer for me? Because I know there's power in prayer, and I truly believe that. Once again, celebrate recovery is what we're talking about. And today I celebrate recovery each and every day as a beautiful gift. I mean, I didn't deserve this. I mean, I should be locked up and I should be dead, one or the other. And I feel God gave me an opportunity to straighten up and to keep moving forward, keep moving forward, you know, being a vessel to try to help others out, try to give faith and hope to somebody else, you know.
There you go, and that demonstrates humility when you say I didn't deserve it, and when you view recovery as a gift, that demonstrates again humility and gratitude as well. So, what are some of your other life's goals right now? Let's education goals, career goals, that type of thing.
Yeah, so you know, when I was trying to sober up, I did have a lot of big plans, big goals, and so I moved away for a couple of reasons to go back to school, and wherever I went, I came with me. So in a sense that, you know, I didn't change anything when I left, so which means that nothing was going to improve wherever I went. Yeah. So I always had to come back home and stuff.
So you went to a different city or state?
Yes, I tried two geographical locations.
Right. Geographical cures or,
It didn't work, Tom. I had to come home and fix what I needed to fix back here first before I, you know, would leave. But I do have a goal. I always had a goal of going back to school and going back to college and getting another degree. And it's a blessing from God that I'm able to work hard enough throughout each and every day in every area of my life to get me up to this point to be able to start school. And I'll be starting school August 21st.
Nice.
Bismarck State College. I'll be studying renewable energy and energy services. So
renewable energy and energy service. Great.
Yes, that's
services,
correct. Yeah. Yep. And nice. I'm just looking forward for the opportunity to, when I take one step, God takes two, which means that I'm going to put forth the effort and do my very best each and every day. And I won't know unless I try. You know, it's a kind of a scary thought to be back into school after being graduated for 10 years. But I really love to learn, and I really love that setting of learning new skills and stuff like that. And I'm interested to see what doors open with this opportunity and go from there.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, and I know that you inspire others. You know, I've seen you work with others, and I watch you at RAD. You know, at Runners Against Destructive Decisions and that type of thing. I told you this would go fast, and we probably have about a minute left. Yep, any final words? And by the way, we close this program every week with the Serenity Prayer too. So
okay,
any final thoughts?
There's a success story I want to tell people about. There was an individual in the state of Kansas, and he had spent time in federal prison growing up. Had a similar background as me. He ended up spending a lot of time in federal prison, and he found himself spiritual in his cell. Got sober. When he got released, he started a few community programs and stuff like that. And a little bit of time after that, he is now currently a mayor of a small town, I think in Leavenworth, Kentucky.
Okay.
So it's a beautiful success story to know that people who've come from my background, my struggles, and you hear other people having struggles like that and look at their success story. Any of us can do it. Any of us can do it, Tom.
If we just take one day at a time.
Absolutely, right? One day at a time, yep.
And keep doing the next best thing, they say. And our guest has been Brandon Bagenstos. Good to have you. We'll have to have you back.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate you having me here.
So thank you. And let's close with the Serenity Prayer.
All right.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
Thank you.
I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a setting sun.